Space Five, acting as one, dedicated, inseparable, invincible.
Welcome to Pod Stallions, the official podcast of Plaid Stallions. As always, I'm Brian, and to my left on the West Coast is Jason.
Hello, everybody.
And we've got a very special guest in the Midwest. It's Mr. Alex Ross. Hello, Alex.
Hello. Hey, everyone.
And the topic today is rather fitting because we're all fans of this show. So, and I think we all kind of have a different connection to it, and that is what was known to us as Battle of the Planets, but known to kids around the world as Gotcha Man. So let's get right into it. Jason, what was your first experience with Battle of the Planets?
Yeah, it's funny. It's very tied into Doctor Who, oddly enough, which is a show we've done a Pod Stallions on before.
Oh, their first episode.
Yeah, I seem to have a very strong recollection of coming home in the afternoon, 1978, and, you know, people swear that even back then, Doctor Who was on public television, which would have been, you know, where I grew up would have been our Channel 2 was our public television, and then Channel 9 was the syndicated station, you know, that ran Godzilla movies on the weekends and ran Star Trek and whatever.
The good station.
The good station, yeah. Yeah. And so I seem to recall that Doctor Who, before it was edited into those 2-hour, you know, movies on Friday nights, it did air every day. They did a half hour episode every day. And I don't remember it being on Channel 2. I thought it was on a different station that was syndicated, but maybe I can get an answer on that. Maybe that's how it first came over here. I thought it was on different stations before
it did get sold to syndicated television at one
time. That's what I thought. And it was because they used to do these intros. There used to be like recap.
Henry Silva did them, or not Henry Silva. The man's name is Henry. I can't.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, there was like an American-only special like recap. Yeah. You know, on yesterday's episode, the Doctor was caught in a blah 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 blah. You know, they would do that sort of thing.
Because you know you couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. But it was a mental show. It was very weird. But I do remember that. So I think that was on a different station. And then whatever it was, I had to flip over. So if that was on at like 4 o'clock, I would flip over at 4:30 to Battle of the Planets, or 3 or 3:30, whatever it was. And I remember seeing a commercial for Battle of the Planets. And I, you know, as we all, I think, sort of suspected, I thought it was a brand new animated series that was, you know, space related. And of course, as we've said a million times, anything space related between 77 and 80, we, you know, ate up with a spoon.
Oh yeah.
So I was checking anything out, and I was just hooked on this show. But from the first episode, I remember two things. One, that Doctor Who was this strange, I didn't know what the show was, and it creeped me out. It was scary and weird. And then Battle of the Planets, I remember very early on, A, being totally jazzed that a character was called Jason.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a huge, huge deal for me. But B, that there was bitching and arguing going on between these characters, mainly between – I always thought – even as a kid, I thought, boy, Jason's really kind of a hothead and rubbing people the wrong way. And there was always this sort of conflict between Jason and Mark. So that's my first recollection. I'm not sure I ever saw any merchandise. I think I saw coloring books like that Whitman did, like coloring books or puzzles and things like that. But I'm not sure I ever saw any of the U.S. rack toys that made it out that year or any of that stuff. But
wait, what did we have any that were here in the States?
Yeah, we
really?
Did. Yeah, we got about 10. I'll let Brian take it in a minute, but we got about 10 really cool rack toys.
Yeah, we got a few different things. We didn't get anything that we would have given a crap about at 8 or 9 years old, like action figures or ships. But We got a board game from Milton Bradley that used artwork from subsequent seasons of Gatchaman. So there's characters on there that we would not know who they are.
Right, yeah.
We got a lunch pail from, I think, Aladdin.
I think I have that, yeah.
The Gold Key comic books.
Yeah, have those.
I have some of those, too. That's one of the things I did have.
And then Henry Gordy, which is a name synonymous with Rack Toys, slapped Battle of the Planet stickers on things like signal ray guns and saucer guns and that sort of thing. Once you pop that off the card, there's absolutely no relation to the series. Yeah.
Right, I get it. Yeah, I didn't think there was much more than that because I think just like you, as Jason was telling me, went and searched up a lot of merchandise on this, in the last 20 years and found, a bevy of things that were from an international marketplace, especially, of course, Japan, where they had loads of different action figures, vehicles, and whatnot. For me, my entire collection was sort of sparked off by the release in the mid-90s of the 12-inch figures from, was that Metacom?
It was, yeah. Metacom did I guess they'd be Joe and Ken, but Mark and Jason to us, and then
was there any answer that you're aware of why they never went any further?
I really don't know. Other than that, perhaps it's sales. I don't know. I know that Cygirl released a princess doll.
In fact, I can claim one thing for my own involvement with the property that one of the later releases of Cygirl, they did some special version of it that had like a slick black princess outfit, and I think a white. There was like a variant version of it they did later down the line after their initial release, and the chest emblem with the second release was the one that I designed for T-shirt usage that was released by Dynamic Forces in the early 2000s.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
That's cool.
Yeah, like there was no exact template for the bird symbol as there was for the G. There's a very exact kind of drawing for the G. No question about it. You see it on tons of merchandise. But for every merchandise thing you might get from Japan of the bird, it's like it's being drawn anew each and every time. So I tried to create one that was based tightly upon the turnaround art that I, obviously had copies of, and created this sort of sharpened version of it that does appear on at least that particular product and, of course, the T-shirts that I had involvement with.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, there was a real resurgence of product right around the late 90s, early 2000s, and I was kind of hoping that would keep going, but it seemed to kind of
peter out.
Well,
we killed it with the comic book series.
Well,
we capitalized on the excitement, and then we killed it. So.
One of the 8 or 9 Rack Toys that were made. There's one I think I've told you this before, Brian, that I am obsessed with getting if you can ever find it, and they did like a projector gun. It was a standard projector gun. It was made a million times by a million different companies. But it was this gun that had a square sort of barrel, and it had a little bulb in it and took batteries. And then it came with like 2 or 3 slides, plastic slides that had images of the characters on them.
Oh, yeah. I've never actually seen one of those.
Real small. And when you put the slide in the front of the barrel, it would supposedly project a larger image on the wall, but it's really cool because it's just these tiny little images of the characters. But let's rewind just a second. So that was my exposure. I'm guessing Alex's was pretty similar because it was syndicated around the same time, right, Alex?
Well, it depends on where you live in the country. And Brian, are you from America or are you from Canada?
I'm Canadian.
Okay. Yeah. So, depending on your circumstance of good syndication, your town and wherever, state. In my case, it was, I was in the middle of Texas when that show came out in America. And the way that I saw it was not through syndication on my local television, but I think it was HBO, maybe, that had it in the late 70s. Does that sound possible to anybody?
Wow. I wouldn't know. But let me see if it's on the Wikipedia page.
I just know it was somewhere on pay cable that friends that I knew for only about a year who lived across the street from me in a rental house, I visited these young kids, and well, I was young too, I was like 7 or 8, whatever year it was, and seeing it in their home, and that was my first exposure. So,
that's interesting.
You know, I would then get syndicated exposure, not by my town in Texas, but by where my family is from, up here in Chicago, where in the suburb we visit here, Evanston, I would spend a couple weeks with my grandmother every summer for vacation and watch what was here, I think possibly on Channel 32, but that doesn't matter for your listeners nationwide.
Going local.
But anyways, yeah, I got a chance for a couple weeks a year to be exposed to this thing. I also had to get up like really early. It was something like 7 or 8 in the morning that they were running these reruns, you know. But I was desperate to see as much of the show as I could, and it was making an enormous impact on my young mind. I started basing a lot of characters that I made up as a young kid upon the concepts from the show.
Would you figure though you were about, you know, that was about the same time, like you were probably 8, 9 years old, 1978, 79 kind of thing?
Well, that's only when this came over. Sandy Frank, the guy who worked directly for Sandy Frank, told me about, you know, how they got it. And they only got the rights after Star Wars came out, which is 77. And so they went to this sort of international emporium of different licenses and products that they then saw the show and thought, hey, we can turn that into looking like it's a space opera.
Yeah, it's
even though, as we know, that show's not about space, really.
No, it's actually kind of environmental. And very much a product of 1972, if you really look at it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, they did not get that thing over there any faster than we're talking about it being available for us to see.
Yeah.
And then what was when did you sort of first see it, Brian? Was it a different time frame for you?
No, I think it was teased in August of 78, I'd say. We got it. It wasn't syndicated here. It was picked up by Global Television, which was one of our networks. And, you know, they would play, they you know, they would work on their own original programming, but most of the time Global, what they did is they picked up, like, American programs and played them on Canadian channels, right? So they would play with Canadian commercials and content. So Battle of the Planets was on Global, which was Channel 3 here. Every day, I think at around 4:30 or 5:30.
Okay.
It was 5:30. So that's, you know, you couldn't ignore it if you were a kid. Especially me, I didn't get a lot of channels. So that was it. That, you know, and I luckily really enjoyed it. And it completely fascinated me because, and this is one of the questions I wanted to pose to both of you guys is, did you see through the cracks as a kid?
You mean that it might have been something else from a different time, or that?
The
edits and all that kind of thing.
No, I bought it hook, line, and sinker. I thought it was. I didn't know. In fact, I don't think I even knew until much, much later. Maybe like early 20s. I don't. Maybe the no. It had to be before the 12-inch figures came out. But I'm not sure when I discovered what it really was. That it was. I mean, initially, I discovered that it had a different name. And that it had been changed, you know, picked up and changed, you know, for other parts of the world. But I'm not sure when I understood that it was that much earlier. You know, it was much, much earlier.
Yeah, I would bet that I didn't learn any of that stuff until the 90s.
See, when I was a kid, the thing that got me when I was a kid was two things. And this is my wife's a big fan. So we joke about this is whenever Mark and Princess visited Seven's Arc 7, it looked weird.
Right.
And they never moved. But the thing that drove me mad as a kid was they would go to another planet. You know, they would show the scene of the ship going to the other planet, and they'd land on this other planet, and it would be like, why are there Datsuns on that planet? You know, like, why does it look like my backyard? Like, there was just something I didn't quite believe.
Yeah,
and there's a few episodes of that show that are just, they don't make sense. There's one where Zoltar kidnaps a young couple and turns them into like robots or something, and you don't quite understand what's going on. And I can remember that, you know, these things are making an impression on your mind when you're a kid. And you,
well, wasn't there also, and I just know this from talking to other kids about the show, that like there was something about Keop was supposed to be a robot,
a clone.
He wasn't a real boy, like he was a clone.
Yeah. And
okay,
there was a rumor for years that Keop, the character Jinpei on Battle of the Planets, was swearing all the time. and they had to cover that up with that it's not true. It was just an angle, I think, you know, and more, they were shoving as much science fiction in there as they could.
Well, think about it. This is the crudest, I mean, I'm not trying to really insult Sandy Frank too badly here, but I mean, think about how blatant it is to reveal the origin of this thing by the name itself. It was trying to cash in on Star Wars, so they renamed this cartoon Battle of the Planets. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it might as well have been called Space, you know...
Space Wars.
Conflicts. Yeah. It really was a blatant way to try and cash in on Lucas's thing. It was just far less obvious as, you know, Lucas didn't take them to court like he did with Battlestar Galactica.
Right. Yeah, and
yeah, it's funny, you know, I didn't notice, again, like you talk about the animation, that's something that I didn't notice until many, many years later, that something was off and looked, you know, different. And whenever they shot, the robot and the dog didn't really notice, but when any of the other characters were in there, you could tell the animation was, you know, was very different. Okay, so let me just go back again. So it appeals to us. On whatever level, we're kids, we're digging it, whatever. But I want to start with Alex because...
Well, you know, one thing I could also mention, too, just to put a little bit of context to this for people, if there's a chance there's anybody listening to this that doesn't entirely understand why this thing is what it is, if there's anybody who's kind of curious and then they go check it out and go, I don't know why this thing would be so amazing to these guys... The difference is we were used to such a limited scope of animation in that period, adapting dramatic subject matter, you know, adapting superheroes, adapting science fiction, and all the stuff was generally really, really weak. And the standard for that would be sort of the Hanna-Barbera style for, you know, like the Super Friends and such. There was never any sense of real aggression, never really any sense of real fighting amongst protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, aside from Tom and Jerry, so this was startling to watch the show that felt vividly like something real and tough was going down.
Well, but that goes back to the question I was going to ask is, and you and I've had 8,000 conversations about different things, and I always make this analogy where, you know, referring to Alex and I, like we can talk about, you know, the new Batman film or Battle of the Planets or whatever it is, and we're looking at it with, you know, similar eyes and similar sort of criticism and exposure, the way we kind of look at stuff. But then Alex, you know, has this different set of eyes that he looks at stuff with because of his background and because of the artistic thing and, you know, being able to draw.
And also because of the surgery.
And because of the surgery, right. Bionics. But then so something about this is appealing to you visually on a level that it's probably appealing to us too. We don't even know it, but like, what is it about this show? Because you've talked about this with me, like how influential it is in the design. And we've talked about the outfits, you know, what is it about this show that kind of sets it apart? And what is it about it that appealed to you visually that I really do think it's as ridiculous as some of the costumes can be as a concept. They're pretty ridiculous on paper, but it works somehow, and it's different and different looking. What is it about in a nutshell that appeals to you?
Boy, in a nutshell, I don't know how to nut it up here. But
well, you don't have to nut it up then. Don't nut it up.
But you know, it basically, this is the prototype show for all the things that we've come to recognize as kind of the prototype of Japanese live-action group shows, where you've got five members, one female out of the five. And they're multicolored, and they're doing either dinosaurs or they're doing this set of things or whatever. And
it's
so
the first five-man show.
Exactly. And, you know, our most recognized version of that in the States, of course, is...
Power Rangers.
Power Rangers, yes. So Power Rangers
Golden
don't
Girls?
Exist without the show.
Right. Well, that, I mean, did this sort of then set the template for all of those shows, Voltron?
Yeah, and of course, that's, you know, I mean, this happened more, there was more of this kind of thing going on in animation, but this really kicked off the wave of that stuff, that live action kind of thing there. But aesthetically, as far as what the show had that I love so much about it is, graphically, they were the most real feeling characters of adapting comic-like constructs on television, because the line work that's in the standard animation of those shows is much more involved than you were going to find in the simple line outline around figures that you would find from either the Hanna-Barbera studios or Filmation studios. They would be a single line outline around Flash Gordon or Spider-Man or whoever. And here, it was a broken line that was kind of sketchy. So, like, when you would see the drawings of, so just say, a Mark's face, whether in or out of costume, it was this very elaborate, much more drawn-in line that was very sketchy, much more rendered. So there was a more rendered life, much like you would have in a comic book drawing, where there'd be a greater amount of ink line work. So it was much more vivid, impetuous reality. And of course, there was an anger aspect to the stuff where Mark looked like a very aggressive, angry kind of intense figure. His eyebrows were very angled and sharp, and his eyes were big and bold, and there was something very vivid. Now, it wasn't to be confused with how the standard Japanese art style for a lot of anime had the oversized eyes that become distracting. These were far less than that. They were much more modest out of the entire body of work composed from various Japanese animation studios. This had a much more, I would say, Caucasian-centric look to it.
I would say so, too. Yeah, in fact, yeah. So much so that when I was watching the live-action movie that just came out recently, I had trouble with it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, I just pictured them differently, I guess.
Exactly. Well, yeah. You know, part of the thing that we come at it with is realizing that those characters were designed to be Caucasian, effectively, except that in, you know, the original Japanese, they were just expected to be fellow Japanese characters. But then why do they have blue eyes? Or, you know, I mean, but still, they had Caucasian features. But when it gets translated into Asian actors playing those roles, it doesn't feel like it connects with what the basic art style was.
Yeah, it the same thing happened with the Star Blazers movie, because you've got blonde characters, and, you know, it's just, all right, well, you know, it takes a minute to get used to, almost.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to watch further iterations of the live-action Ultraman stuff and things like that,
yes.
Because his first existence is with actors playing it, Asian actors, not with drawings.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there was a movie made, quite a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago now, that was from the same Tatsunoko Studios that created Gatchaman, of their character that looked very much like one of the Gatchaman,
Polymer?
Kashan.
Oh, okay.
No, I haven't seen, is there a Polymer movie?
No, I've seen a Polymer OAV. I'm a huge fan of Polymer as well, so I don't think
there
is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I never liked the design for the Polymer red costume as much, but I've been a huge fan of the Kashan character.
Now, doesn't he kind of look a bit like what would be Mark's father?
Jeez.
Okay, I might be going off on a wrong tangent there.
Well, he looks like he's got a Gatchaman outfit in white with a little face mask covering up his lower face.
Oh, okay, I know who you're talking about.
You know, he doesn't have a cape, and he's got a robot dog that's
yeah.
his companion. Great looking design. He's got a C on his chest and everything.
I've got a fake.
Kashern?
Kashern.
Is that what you pronounce it?
Yeah, and you know what?
I have a
Mego prototype of him from Italy.
Oh.
There was a company there called New Jayaku that was going to make an 8-inch Kashern figure.
Okay.
I've actually got one of those.
Well, they did make a live action movie of that before this current thing we just saw of Gatchaman, and it had the same kind of weirdness to it, where, like, you're seeing an Asian actor playing this part and going, wow, this just doesn't seem like the same character. You know, something seems off about this. And they also made the cardinal sin of having the character never wear his signature helmet that the character always wore in the anime, And
yeah. Oh,
they show
you know
it in
what
the movie, but, you know.
I think I saw a review of that, but I've yet to see the actual film.
Yeah, check it out sometime. It's interesting. It's very long and ponderous. It has a lot of the same defects that are in the current feature, I'm afraid to say. But, you know, I hope there's somebody actually who sees that movie who's prideful enough about what stuff they make out of Japan that they'll actually be angry about criticisms that we make here. That way we know so, we've made it if yeah. we actually get somebody pissed off, you know.
Would you say then that collectively that this is also probably the first what is technically anime that we're exposed to? I mean, I don't remember seeing much Astro Boy as a little kid.
Oh, well, I mean, you've got Astro Boy, you've got Speed Racer was in heavy syndication.
Oh, Speed Racer, yeah, that would have been first then, Speed Racer.
You know, that made it over here, I think, by the late 60s.
Yeah, I remember Speed Racer before Battle of the Planets, yeah.
And you got to also know that Ape-Man, he made it over to the States in syndication before even Speed Racer, and that was black and white cartoons.
Yeah, I can't remember that, but I do remember that.
None of us would have been alive for that.
I know, but these things do tend to linger. The one I remember the most was flicking over to the French channel as a kid, and they used to get all kinds of anime that we didn't get. My wife
is
French.
Well, there was a big following in France for a lot of these characters.
They were
Goldorak and whatnot.
Goldorak and Albator, like. My wife's French, so she grew up on all this stuff, and she knows those characters.
There you go.
Battle of the Planets was La Bataille de Planets there.
Okay.
French La Bataille.
Yeah. But, yeah, and you know what's really kind of interesting is in Quebec, they got all that merchandise from France. I found at flea markets the odd time a 12-inch G.I. Joe version of Captain Harlock, or they got the Shogun Warrior of Goldorak, or you know, just things like that we didn't get in English-speaking Canada. But I think these things were imported from France because the shows were being aired there.
Yeah,
and it's like I wish that kind of thought was done for us more in English-speaking Canada, because I'd love to have gotten some of that stuff. And subsequently, I've talked to some people who grew up in San Francisco, who have said that the Japanese toy stores in Chinatown or wherever would actually carry like the Popey 8-inch Ken from Battle of the Planets.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know? That's one of my favorite collectibles that getting that, I think, was one of the best things. Getting most of the Poppy figures that they had done, or Popey, however you pronounce it, was something I was very proud of assembling because I'm such a Amigo nut.
Do you have all the, what's the five-man show they did there? Battle Fever ones?
Battle Fever. Is that the one with the different countries?
Yeah.
You know what? Nearly all. I'm missing, I think, the one from Kenya. I couldn't find that for less than like $300, $400 online.
Yeah, he's a toughie.
I just didn't want to spend that.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I got pretty much everybody else.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the Kamen Rider figures they did.
Oh, sure, yeah. No, I got all those, and I guess, yeah, there was only the one guy from Gatchaman, but, still. And then I think I have like they made a variant of the Superman that we had anyways in the States. It was exactly the same.
Yeah. So. And do you have the in France they took the Super Joe body and the Space Academy bodies that Hasbro did, and they made Mark, Princess, and Kiop?
I have the Kiop.
Yeah. They're the problem with them is, and Jason, I don't know if you're familiar with Super Joe by Hasbro. It was right after they canceled the Adventure Team, they made a space version of G.I. Joe, and he's Mego-sized. But they used this weird nylon to put him together, and it disintegrates.
Well, mine's still holding together, believe it or not.
Kiop, I think, it survives better than the rest because he's on that Space Academy body, and the kid body seems to hold together better.
I didn't know that. That's very interesting. That's fascinating, actually.
I have a mark where his fists just disintegrated recently. I'm real thrilled about that. But I have a collection of the Hasbro Super Joe figures, and they're all on the card, and they're all just body parts. at the bottom.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's a shame.
It's actually kind of funny. Like, now I'm just kind of amused with it, but, it would drive you crazy if you thought about it.
Well, I remember seeing those when those came out in the late 70s and just thinking, like, what are these things? They're so bizarre, and they were trying to create new characters. And I just, find that fascinating, given the fact that they would strike gold in just a few years later when they decided to downsize to the smaller Star Wars size.
Yeah.
And now, of course, G.I. Joes have been a constant for so long, but it's fascinating that they tried something innovative in the late 70s with, more spacefaring and whatever you want to call that. I remember there's some see-through plastic that was used on the aliens.
Yes.
Okay.
The good guy, I think, actually, what's it? Luminos. He's see-through.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No,
like
I've got some books on that stuff.
Yeah.
I love looking at pictures of that old stuff. I had no idea that the actual toys were just pretty much pieces if you bought them at all.
Yeah. There's only one character that seems to survive, and that is the villain, Gore. Who's just like a big lizard, and I don't know if they used a different type of construction for him, but Gore, the King of the Terrans, is the only one that, I guess he won, because the other guys are all disembodied.
Yeah, you should check these out sometime, Jason. They're really cool-looking figures. I mean, they were really – in fact, it might even trigger a memory for you if you check out the images of them, and you might go, oh, wow, I remember when these things were out there, because I never bought them myself, but they formed a memory that would stick in my head for the next 35 years.
Well, there's a site. Well, we'll get back to the show for a second, because there's regarding collectibles though and stuff, because there's a whole world out there that I wasn't aware of for the longest time. I literally have like a few of the diamond pieces that were made. I have one of the squirt guns, the Gordy International squirt guns on the card. And, well, recently I picked something up that's pretty rare, and it took forever to get here. But I got a company called Crescent in the UK did a laser rifle. It's called an electronic sound rifle for Battle of the Planets, and it's basically just it's a white space rifle. Here's one of the sounds. Who says that stuff didn't sound cool in the 70s? And it has, the toy itself has nothing to do with Battle of the Planets, but the box is really cool because it's got Seven Zark 7 and Mark on it and a scene on the back and stuff, but it's really, really hard to find still in the box and everything. But there's nothing, I don't remember anything being around really as a kid for the show that I loved so much. And I knew other kids at school were talking about this show. So it was on, it must've been on for a good year or so. I don't know how many episodes were made but I don't remember it being around much after that. It just seemed to kind of be this burst in the late 70s, and then it was kind of gone until Cartoon Network started running it again over here. I can remember
turning on the TV like in the seventh grade, so like 1981, 1982-ish, and it was like 6:30 in the morning, and I was up, and I turned on the TV and Battle Planets was on, and I can remember being all nostalgic. So I think you're right. I think it kind of faded away. Now, mind you, I got bored of it after about a year and a half because I'd seen every episode three times.
Oh, see, yeah, I think I just remember seeing it that one. God, it's funny you say that nostalgia thing, because that reminds me of the Star Trek animated series,
which I also used to get up at 6:30 in the morning to watch around that time.
Because it all of a sudden, it was running all of a sudden in like 1980 or 81.
Yeah.
One of the networks was running it here, and I was like, I remember seeing it and just going, oh my God, because when it originally aired, I could have only been, 4 or 5 years old, but I remember the show. And so seeing it again, like in the early 80s, I was like, oh my God, like it was like I'd forgotten it existed, sort of.
I honestly think that's why I was up that morning, was to catch Star Trek.
To catch that?
Yeah.
It's funny. So the show comes over here. They repackage it. They call it Battle of the Planets. They dub it with a bunch of American actors.
Yeah, and some notable ones like Ronnie Schell and Casey Kasem and Key Luke.
Yes, that's right. Key Luke was the bad guy, and Casey Kasem, I guess most people would know him as Shaggy.
And Robin.
He did Robin on the Hanna-Barbera thing. He did an American Top 40 radio show here forever and ever. He did the Top 40 like on Sunday nights.
And sadly, he's in the news today.
Is he?
Oh, yeah, his family's fighting over him. He's not well.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, at least you weren't telling us he was dead, though.
No, but it's not. Apparently, he has such severe Parkinson's he can't speak.
And
his children, and this is somewhat positive in a way that it's not a bitter fight over his money. It's a bitter fight over him, like his care. So.
Oh, his care. Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was just on the news, and I was watching it before we signed on, and I guess the kids even said something. One of the daughters said, the stepmom can have all the money. We just want him. So.
Is he still married to?
Yes.
Ghostbusters. What's her name?
He's married to from the Tortellis.
Yeah, she was in Ghost. Remember, Rick Moranis is dancing with her in Ghostbusters.
You know what? I haven't seen Ghostbusters in a very, very long time.
Oh, okay.
Well, we're talking about the giant woman.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
and I assume she's a second wife. She's not the mother of his kids.
No.
Okay.
But I think she's been around for about 30 years with him.
Yeah, exactly. They've been married a very, very long time. So.
So he's probably the most
recognizable
voice in Battle of the Planets. And I think it must have been post-Shaggy, because Shaggy was, I think, his early 70s.
Shaggy, I think Scooby-Doo came out in 69, so.
Yeah, so, and it must have been post-Robin, too.
Oh, well, yeah, he was doing Robin since the early 70s as well.
Yeah, so he
It's not post-Robin, because, I mean, he continued to do new seasons of the Super Friends.
And Scooby-Doo.
All the way, I think, up until the Super Powers show?
Adam West took over, but I don't think Burt Ward did. Yeah, I think you're right. I think he continued to do that. Because Adam West replaced Olan Sewell at some point in the Superpowers show.
I used to love that guy's voice. What was the guy you just said did Batman?
Olan Sewell.
I love that dude's voice. It's so distinctive. It's so so odd. But
The very bipolar opposite of Batman when you look at him, though.
Yes, I've seen images. So it kind of goes away from the time we're kids, and maybe comes back like Alex. Do you end up sort of rediscovering it did it go away for a while and then you came across it again? Like, did you once you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I forgot about how much of an influence this thing had on me, because I had no merchandise or any copies of the show when I was growing up, so it took pretty much returning to Chicago full time, coming here to go to school, then ultimately to live here, that I reassociated with the show, which may have been still in some syndication here, and then eventually at some point that I got cable in the 90s, I saw it was back on Cartoon Network, which they did a new version of reworking all of it with new voice actors to represent the shows under the name G-Force.
Yeah, and they'd watered down the violence even further with that.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I don't remember if it was G-Force, or do you guys remember Eagle Riders? Because Saban got a hold of it in the 90s.
Right, and the reason they could do that is because there are later seasons of the show that were not licensed by Sandy Frank that then were available for Saban to license, and that's where he created Eagle Riders.
Yeah, and then it must have been G-Force, because it was an episode of Battle of the Planets, and it was one I remembered, and I was watching it in my apartment, and there was it's an episode where a guy is looking for his father, and he falls through the floor, and they find a skeleton with his father's ring on it in Battle of the Planets. They say, "That's my father's ring. Oh, no." And in this new version, the guy falls through the floor, and he goes, "There's my father's ring. He must have put it on that skeleton as a message to me."
Oh my gosh, completely
obscuring. And they would do things like that, where somebody would die in an explosion, and then they would have an epilogue, and it would go, "Thank goodness we all got out of that explosion, including that little girl," or whatever. And you'd just be like, "Oh my God, they're."
By the way, that goes. I'm getting off on a big tangent here, but if you remember, what it should be in the news, of course, because of Gwen Stacy and the new Spider-Man movie and everything. Her original death in the comics was one that was rewritten to reflect Stan Lee's sensitivities of how it was being handled, because Spider-Man was 100%, well, no, he was 50% at fault for why she died. In the comics, she was falling. He catches her with his web. There's not enough bounce in the web at that point. So when she's caught at such a tremendous rate of speed of falling from this bridge, her spine cracks, and the sound effect is in there in the final printed comic. But what dialogue is added afterwards, I think it might have been in the following issue that picked up with this cliffhanger story, is basically kind of explaining that, like, oh, well, she died before you even caught her because the shock of the fall got to her.
Oh.
Which, okay, the thing is, none of that makes sense, because when she was knocked off the bridge, she was unconscious. There's no shock.
Right.
She was just a limp body falling to her doom, and then Spider-Man catches her, and again, it's Spider-Man's action that completely stopped her stopped her life. So you had that kind of retroworking, or that kind of sort of trying to soften up the harshness of the violence going on then, which I had heard was actually ordered by Stan, the man himself. So,
speaking of, I'll go on another tangent. Do you remember? Well, maybe not in Canada, but certainly here in the, I want to say late '90s or mid '90s, when Turner, I think it was Turner Networks, would run the Looney Tunes, the Warner Brothers stuff. Mm-hmm. And if it was especially like one of those, you know, one of the hunting, Elmer Fudd, Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, pronoun trouble kind of episode, you know, in shorts, Elmer Fudd would raise the rifle, and instead of, you'd see them shoot, and you'd see, you know, Daffy in a puff of smoke and this bill fall on the ground, whatever, they would cut to Bugs. So he'd raise the rifle, you'd hear the shot, but it would be on a still image of Bugs Bunny, like looking at the camera. And then you'd come back and see the aftermath of Daffy Duck picking up his bill off the ground, sticking it back on his face. So they would edit out all the violence, the violent act. So just before and just after, but the act itself, they would edit those out of the classic Looney Tunes for a while in the 90s. I don't know what the thinking was. And then somebody, you know, stopped them. But, that was changed that.
Speaking of violence, that's one of the things we should probably touch on. And this is like, I became aware of, I was starting to do video dealing in the 80s, where I would find obscure movies like Legends of the Superheroes, and I would tape, trade, and sell. So I started getting involved, and that's how I got back into Battle of the Planets a little bit. And it was funny, a college roommate of mine remarked one morning, I woke up with bedhead, and he said, "You've got G-Force hair." Nice. I hadn't thought of Battle of the Planets in years, so I picked up some tapes of it, and I went up to, just as I was leaving Chiller Theater in New Jersey, I walked up to a dealer and said, "Do you have the Battle of the Planets where they rip off Zoltar's mask and he's a girl?" And he goes, "This is it right here." And then he sold me another tape. He said, "If you love Battle of the Planets, you've got to see this." So I came back to my dorm room and started watching the tape one afternoon. And that's how I met my wife, because I had my door open. I always had my door open. And she heard the G-Force music, and she was studying down the hall. Ah. And she came in and said, "Are you watching G-Force?" And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "Well, can I watch it with you?" And that's how I met her.
Oh, my gosh. That's right.
But this guy sold me a movie. It was a two-hour finale that was the how Zoltar gets killed. And,
right.
And how and Jason Joe dies in it.
Right.
And the one thing I noticed, and this is something that's great when you're a fan of the show, because, you know, Jason was the badass of the show. But we never saw the feathers as kids. He would stab people with feathers.
Right, right.
And they really did a good job of editing that out.
Oh yeah, he had the he had a gun.
He had the gun. Had feathers,
but then didn't Mark had like a boomerang kind of thing.
Yeah, and that thing.
Yeah,
was...
he's got the bird boomerang thing.
But yeah, they
it was a violent, but I mean it seemed kind of violent. Well, like I said, it also seemed like there was a combativeness. So they certainly whatever they altered the script, they certainly
kept that. One of the craziest things I could describe to you that's from the original shows, and of course if you've watched the real thing, you know what this is. Amongst, I don't know, first season's episodes, whatever, within, let's say, the first five, there's clearly a scene where he slaps June in the face. And this is one of those things where Mark, or Ken, is kind of keeping his team in line, like, hey, buck up, soldier, kind of thing, like, and just slap. And you see this now and you realize, like, oh, shit. Oh, sorry.
No, you can't.
We used to not be bothered by that in entertainment. That was something that was not that bizarre.
Right.
Or, frankly, it could have been your case in your family that your parents, your father or mother, might have been very comfortable to slap you across the face in quick reaction for something you did.
Yeah, absolutely. And that yeah, you're right. You wouldn't bat an eye at certain things back in the day.
Yeah, it was a whole different world, but yeah, this was something that was right there in one of those shows, and to see it again, and like, oh my God. And of course, you know, I'm sure they cut that for the Battle of the Planets version of this, but if you watch the ADV videos, which have translated the entire series run with new voice acting matching the scripts with no editing of the original material, you'll see what it really was in its context.
I was watching a Battle of the Planets, and some little bits still slip by, and there's one I was watching with my kid. It was Keop is impersonating a Spectra guard, and which is really believable, and he walks into their off-duty quarters and they're all smoking.
Yeah.
And they're drinking too. They've got beer bottles, but of course it's not addressed, it's just sort of in the background, but I just thought that was kind of funny.
Right, yeah. And, of course, back in the 70s, that wouldn't have been such a stop-the-presses kind of moment,
yeah,
whereas
yeah.
Now, I mean, you can't even have that in a damn comic book these days.
Yeah, I've
you know,
noticed that.
Smoking has become so verboten, we're trying to destroy it by pretending
it doesn't exist
in culture.
Yeah, yeah, except for Quentin Tarantino.
So was the show, you know, and I don't know enough about... you know, the anime world or the, you know, the Japanese stuff, but was the show originally made for a different audience? Was it made for like a kid audience, or was it just that kids were more advanced, or they were more used to seeing things like that?
Absolutely. They were. Plus it was also prime time, right?
Yeah.
Oh, was it prime time?
Yeah. It was like the Flintstones. I mean, it was prime time viewing in Japan.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It wasn't a Saturday morning thing. Am I correct?
I'm not 100% sure, actually, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me. But, you know, going back to stuff for kids, I'm a huge fan of Kamen Rider, and that is mm-hmm. definitely I don't think it's Saturday morning, but it's whatever, a kid's block of shows. And mm-hmm. I have an episode of Kamen Rider, I think it's 1971, 1972, I'm not sure, where he's fighting a vampire. And the vampire jumps in the air. It's like a big bat. And he jumps in the air with a sword and just does a swing. And the whole screen fills up with blood. So and it's just, it's like red paint pouring on the camera, you know. So they're not prudes when it comes to violence.
No, they didn't have that kind of issue there. But, yeah, so ask, were they more advanced than us? The answer is, well... now that we have as many buckets of blood on television through The Walking Dead and all the other zombie ephemera that we're indulging in these days, how advanced are we?
Yeah.
I mean, now that we're on the other side of this, where violence is so much not verboten, you know, I don't know what we're doing well exactly. It's kind of a giant question mark.
So was it a big hit when it first came on the air over there? Did you guys know that throughout the years?
I know it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they did three different iterations of it through the 70s, and you know, they changed it each time. You know, the Phoenix changed. There are model kits that were released there was some merchandise that came over to the States, like model kits by Antex, that say the Phoenix. But they're not the Phoenix from the first series. They're like the second series Phoenix, which must have confused the hell out of kids.
Right.
And I think some of the other Japanese toys actually got released in the UK from the third. The third Phoenix is kind of a bland-looking thing. But I have a friend who his parents are Chinese, and they would go back to Hong Kong every summer. He's probably listening, hi, Ed. And he used to tell me that he would go, like, in 78 to Hong Kong, watch the third season of Battle of the Planets, you know, or Gatchaman, and come back and go, yeah, in the third season they have this ship that splits out, and people would just be like, you're a liar.
Right.
It's, like, very traumatic for him.
But is now, when they introduced, like, the stuff where the ship broke apart into different pieces or became somewhat animated, that was almost like beginning the beginning roots of the Transformers in some ways. They were ahead of the curve on that, right?
Absolutely. And that's the one thing I really love. I wish American comics would do more of this, and is, you know, Kamen Rider, you get a new Kamen Rider every year. The last guy exists, but this is like a new guy in his story.
Oh, so basically like the same model as the Ultraman show.
Absolutely the same thing. I just use Kamen Rider as an example because I'm staring at something. But yeah, Ultraman, the same thing. The last Ultraman's still there, but this is the new Ultraman and his story, and it can be...
By the way, there's a live-action feature of all the Ultraman together. I don't know how many years old it is now, five
I've got
or six
that
years
one.
Old.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful, and everybody's in it, including Ultra 7, the original actors.
Oh, really?
Fantastic. Oh, yeah, yeah.
See,
actors make reappearances in the story.
I just watched a Kamen Rider film that's all the Kamen Riders in the current one, and I have some problems with the way the current ones look. They look like just walking toy commercials. But only a couple of the original actors actually appear. You know, the rest of them, they don't talk during the movie. But, you know, that is a very physically demanding role, so I guess you're not going to get a 70-year-old guy jumping around like that.
Exactly, yeah.
So it did pretty well when it was on, and then it builds this cult status throughout the years, and then...
I would have to assume that this is one of the major tent poles of a lot of Japanese pop culture, that they never forget how important Gatchaman is to building up all this kind of stuff that they know of today in all these other different forms. They just may not have the style of how Kamen Rider, and Ultraman keep rebirthing. They don't have that with Gatchaman.
Yeah.
So, like, getting the feature film that they finally just made is a big deal for getting that done there. But it would, you know, we were so close to that happening here.
Yeah, it's weird, too, because it's the same property, but it's not, because we've put our stank on it so much. You know,
keep in mind, the thing that was going to be done here was a license with Tatsunoko. It was not through Sandy Frank.
Oh, okay.
So it was not going to have anything to do with the Americanized version, and it was going to be heavily reborn. As I told Jason before we had this interview, I said, like, I've got this, you know, insight into what that project was going to be before it went belly up. And what's interesting is, of course, they do the redesign of the costumes just like they did in the movie. Mm-hmm. Although theirs, I would say, is a little bit more faithfully driven. But they were going to do a story that effectively was a lot like the movie X-Men, where it's about how you meet the rough character of Wolverine, who's out on his own and doesn't know, you know, what to do with his crazy self, and then he finds this group that brings him in and makes him part of their group.
Yeah.
That was what they were going to do with the story of Joe.
Okay.
Joe was basically this, you know, crazy long-haired driver guy who... I saw early animation test stuff with him. I saw conceptual stuff for the entire movie of all the costumes and villains and such, and it looked fantastic, and this was Amagi Entertainment that was doing it. And, again, the whole reason it didn't happen is because the failure of Astro Boy not doing as well in theaters.
That's too bad.
But
yeah, because I remember being down at, like I said, I was down at Comic-Con. This is 4 or 5 years ago, and they had a booth, you know, set up for whatever that production company was, and they were giving away Gatchaman, you know, watches and, you know, digital watches and baseball caps and stuff like that. And so they were pushing it. But yeah, and I wondered what had happened to that because it just sort of went away.
Well, there was a lot of time put into developing it and everything, but they had to put all that stuff on the back burner. I think, as I had heard it, there were various changes of producers that came in and would sort of wipe the team clean and start anew, and that went on for a period of time. You know, the fellow that I met was just one of a number of producers who came through there, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because of the involvement that I had with the revival in comic book form, I was kind of invited to the table of seeing if I had any worthwhile input, I guess, to this. And the one thing that stuck out for me, though, is that as they modify these characters for are accepting them as a group today, the one who would get to have the cool long hair would be Joe. So for contrast's sake, they made Mark have blonde short hair.
Oh.
And it drove me crazy because I just thought, like, wait a minute. So that means basically the lead guy in the movie is going to be the Condor. You know, it won't be the Eagle. The Eagle will be there, but, you know, that's the boring Superman kind of guy. You know, you don't need him to be the lead. And to me, that just struck me as like, wait a minute, that's the driving force of this entire legendary group.
Oh, brother.
I think it's fascinating that, because I hadn't thought of this, but I think it's fascinating that here it is a Japanese series, but the characters look, you know, very, you know, Western. Their physical appearance, their facial features.
Well, so that became a common staple of much
right,
of their
yeah.
anime
so,
from
and so when they go to
know,
make,
the 60s on.
Yeah, and when they go to make a live-action film, something seems off because they're using Asian actors.
As yeah.
characters. But, you know, but also, isn't it – correct me if I'm wrong here. This is my understanding of the whole anime thing, that what was his name? Tezuko, whoever the guy was that created Astro Boy, which is one of the first anime things. If you look at the Astro Boy eyes, they sort of became the standard, you know, anime
yeah.
eyes for many years. And he was hugely influenced by Walt Disney and
yeah.
the Disney
yes.
stuff. So those eyes are essentially, you know, Disney character eyes.
But realistically, why should they have been blue? Because there are no blue-eyed Asians, so why would they do that throughout so many of their characters?
Yeah, I don't know. So they do these eyes, but Battle of the Planets seem to have strayed from that. Like they don't. I mean, do
well they
do
softened
those
it
eyes,
up a bit. You know, they yeah, they went smaller.
Are the Battle of
know,
Planets eyes? What you normally see in anime to this day, or weren't they kind of a one-off kind of different?
Well, you could say that it was the maturation of the anime style from Tatsunoko Studios that basically all the stuff they did in that 70s period, Polymer and Kashern, they all look like the same kind of art style. They had that kind of maturing thing that they look very much like American comic books, I would argue.
You know, before we get a lot of email, you know, I said Kashern because that's how I say it. You may have actually been saying it right, Alex.
I don't know. I mean, there is an R in there, so I don't know. I get none of these things right.
Neither do I. So I just wanted to point out that I'm never right on this stuff.
But the art style, I would say, came to be a lot closer to traditional representative art, which I would say is not exaggerated. So with the exception of, like, when you look at Jinpei, who is clearly an exaggerated, comical-looking figure, that the main protagonists from, you know, Dr. Nambu to, you know, everybody else, they look much closer to a regular drawing of somebody without as much exaggeration to the eyes. But then coming into the 1980s, the style started to go much more extreme for much of the growth of anime. I would say more and more animated features were becoming more outrageous in how much they would make these tiny little noses and then giant eyes and, you know, all the stuff that you know of from the 80s that was popular anime has more of that influence and look to it.
Interesting. So, So
it's like they regressed. It's sort of like they started as Astro Boy, and they came right back to that influence.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you both start collecting, what, like mid-90s, sort of late-90s or mid-90s, start collecting stuff or trying to find stuff from around the world? I have, like I said, I've only got a couple of pieces.
Well, I mean, the internet made that a very possible, too, is that now you had an international store of the stuff coming up online. And even though I don't use a computer myself, per se, I was benefited by having friends that did who would, you know, point out stuff to me and say, hey, you want me to bid for this thing online? And that's how I started to amass the collection that I've got.
Yeah, we started.
No, go ahead, Brian.
We used to make these mechas to big toy expos like Kane County and Chiller Theater just to pick up Gatch and Battle of the Planet stuff in the early 90s. But there was nothing better than the internet explosion of the late 90s. Well, it was bad for my wallet, but, you know.
Well, there's a
By the way, I've been to the Kane County show. I mean, I live reasonably close to that since that's right here in Illinois. So I've been to that many times, and that's when I started, too, my collection of various merchandise.
It's a good way to spend an afternoon, that's for sure. I just haven't been in a couple of years. I want to go back really badly.
Yeah, I probably haven't been there in like 15 or 16 years. So
I haven't been there probably in 4 or 5 years, and it always seems to fall on my daughter's birthday, the spring one. It's driving me nuts. There's just no way, you know.
Well, isn't there there's a great website out there that I think I'd mentioned to you a while ago, Brian, and you knew exactly what I was talking about right away, that is like an archive of all the Battle of the Planet stuff, and, you know.
Yeah, and Alex might know this these fellas too. Jason Hofius, who wrote that great book, I believe you provided the cover for it.
That's right.
It's his website, and it's bar none, it's one of the best. I mean,
do you remember what it's called?
I thought it was because he actually was assisting. He was assisting Sandy Frank at one time.
Well, because I'm trying to find it right now, because there are these French action figures that was it Popey that did
Popey made them in Japan, and they came in a beautiful green box, and then they got released in France and Spain. CGR Bois did them in France. I can't remember if it was in Spain, and they would come on individual cards. And they even did Seven's Arc 7 and One Rover Run.
Little Seven's Arc 7 and the robot dog that were made as little one-offs in little boxes. There's those, but then there were like three or four characters that were made as like 3¾-inch figures.
It's battleoftheplanets.info.
.info. Okay. I'll look for that, because there's a line that was done, I think was in Spain, that are like more 3¾-inch characters.
The action figures, the 3¾-inch, like the Popey figures, are technically 3¾-inch ones that were released, but there's also the ones you're talking about in Spain. I think they're done by a company called Jexan.
Yeah, I'm looking at them right now. There's a Jason. A princess, and then there's one that's really cool because it has Seven's Arc 7 and Rover on the same card.
Yeah, I've got that.
You've got that?
Yeah, I'm looking at it.
Well, give it to me.
I won't. I don't own this stuff. My wife does.
Then ask her to please give it to me.
No, I think she can take me.
What's the problem?
Yeah.
Those are cool. I'd like to get those someday because they – it looked like they would kind of line up with other.
Well, can I ask, do you have a single display cabinet dedicated to stuff or more than one?
Well, you know, we have a collection room, and I've got a whole bunch of Detolfs and different display cabinets. We have half a Detolf that has all the Gatchaman stuff she kept. She did pare it down a little bit. She got more into space Lego for a while. But it's got her favorites in there, and we have a very concentrated Gatchaman section in the house.
Yeah, I'm similar to that. I've got one case that's dedicated to Gatchaman and other related things, you know, oddball things like Devilman and you know, a few other imports, but generally mainly focused on them. And I figured once I hit sort of every figure category that I could think of in terms of shape and size, getting, you know, these oddball different things that fit those things, I pretty much figure, like, I'm done. That's,
well, you know,
I can keep going forever on this stuff.
But what burned her out, and I don't blame her, is every piece of merchandise is usually just Ken. And, you know, the same image of Ken pointing.
Yeah.
And she got really, like, you know, she'd be like, well, no, I think a few years ago I was at a toy show and I found a little vinyl from the 70s of Tiny. And I brought it home just kind of as, you know, it cost me like $10-$12, and I brought it home just as a joke, like, look, it's not Mark, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But I think her favorite piece I ever got her was the there's a magnetic series of figures from France of Seven's Arc 7 and One Rover Run, and they're
those
about,
are the ones. Yeah, those are the ones I was talking about too. They're like, they're single colors, like the robot is like blue plastic and the rover's like yellow plastic.
Yeah, and I got her the rover in the box, and she loves that piece because it's one of her favorite characters, and there's so little relating to that character.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's what's cool. That's when I see these figures, I want to track them down. There's also Bendy figures that were made. What's cool about those is, again, the Jason figure. I'm looking at one right now from Ori Jouet.
Yep.
Rejouet from France, where Jason, it's clearly a different, it's not just a repaint of the figure, because he's got a gun molded into his hand. So it's a different figure altogether. So I mean, I'm trying to collect, you know, the Jason stuff for obvious reasons. There's also listed here, which is mind blowing, a Phoenix like Vertibird toy.
Oh yeah.
In a box, but like, you know, like the, remember the Whirly Bird?
Oh my gosh. I'm looking at it now.
Phoenix that does that, like the Whirly Bird. And on the packaging is Seven Dark Seven and
Zoltar. And yeah.
And Zoltar. Yeah. It's kind of cool. And there's all these die cast vehicles that seem to have been put into like seven or eight different kinds of packaging and boxes from around the world. But
yeah, like in the UK, they got I remember the early days of eBay. Before they had photos, you know, I would just have Battle of the Planets and I'd search it hourly, you know, and you would see like Phoenix diecast, and you'd have to email the seller and go, because the photos weren't really common yet through dial up, and you'd have to go, what's it look like? And they'd send you a tiny thumbnail of this, you know, ship that was from the second season, you know, and not that one, you know. Because I don't know if you probably know this, Jason. The second season, Phoenix looks like a bird.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing. Is like, is it like red and white?
That's mostly white.
Yeah. See, that's different than the one that is on a lot of the packaging and the one that was in the original.
Yeah.
The original season. So yeah, there's lots of cool stuff. But let's go back to Alex's museum, which I've been to.
Mm-hmm.
Not only does he have you know, anime stuff and Battle of the Planet stuff mixed into his cabinets, he's got the ultimate Battle of the Planets collectible. He's got a life-size – well, he has life-size, you know, Kingdom Come Superman, you know, life-size figures, Batman.
Oh, no, it's just Superman. Superman and Batman.
Superman and Batman.
Yeah, my style. They're just my style. They're not specifically those projects, but
I thought the Superman was the Kingdom Come Superman. Am I wrong?
No, he doesn't have the Great Temples. No.
It isn't the Great Temples. Okay. So, but they're all done. They're, you know, molded in and sculpted in his style. And then someone made a life-size.
Well, they look like waxworks because they've got lifelike hair. Well, the Superman has rooted hair in the head, and he's got waxed skin. And so it looks very much like a real person standing there in the full costume and everything. And so, yeah, these lifelike Batman and Superman, and then this other fellow that I got to know who I did a lot of sculpting work with on a number of projects was a costume maker named Larry Mallett, and he was a talented sculptor who wanted to make a life-size Mark and did so. He made a full sculpture of that character, which I have, I believe, the only copy of. I don't think there's any other reproduction of this, but it's with a full vinyl stretch costume he's wearing that's perfectly accurate to the show, and it's a head sculpt with larger than normal glass eyes that were made custom to have that kind of anime look to it, so it looks a little bit more odd, but his face is sculpted based upon the model designs, and it's a beautiful piece, and that's my ultimate thing that everybody who comes into the museum says, oh, is that Speed Racer?
Oh,
because nobody knows who this guy is.
I hope you don't invite them back.
Yeah, that should be your litmus test.
Yeah. Gosh, Alex has invited me back in 2 years. How? It's because that Speed Racer comment you made.
Exactly. Yeah. No, but yeah, it's cool. Weird. People don't get this. They don't know who that character is, and without a movie to back it up, it doesn't really have that much reach in terms of popular culture.
It's funny you say that, but you're right. I think you have to be of a certain age, and then there isn't a lot to remind you of it either.
No, without it getting into theaters. I mean, imagine if they did make this movie they were planning on, and then imagine it was a hit, then who knows? We may have all these kids today. It's the oddity of, like, nobody knew who Iron Man was if you weren't reading comics.
Mm-hmm.
And now everybody knows who Iron Man is. Every little child knows who Iron Man is. A very short time ago, nobody did know. Most people didn't know who Thor was, or most all these Marvel characters. So they've done a great job of keeping this stuff alive and reaching a whole new group of people. But, it's very difficult when you've got these properties that have a lot of years behind them. But, getting them to be reacquainted with a broader pop culture base is not an easy task.
It's a bit like the $6 Million Man.
Exactly.
I mean, I love that show, but they did nothing with it for so long that, my kids know who he is, but it's few and far between.
Yeah, I know. It is funny to think that, like, we think it is just a series from the 70s, but they did stuff going all the way up to the end of the 80s with those original actors reprising their roles, including, I believe, the very first Sandra Bullock starring vehicle was in one of those revivals.
And it was actually filmed in Canada.
So,
what was it? The Sandra Bullock?
There was the worst one. It was the last one. It wasn't the last one. Sorry, the worst one is the one where they get married. That's where, like, Lee Majors. I don't think they're slowing down the film anymore. He's just running, I think it was. It's one.
I remember. I think I'd seen it, like, Sci-Fi must have run it sometime or something. I think
they were trying to spin the Bionic Man off. I think it was the second TV movie, and it was trying to spin the Bionic Man off into a new, Steve's son and this new Bionic Girl, which I think was Sandra Bullock. They have Steve and Jamie, and they're fighting this Russian who's got advanced bionics, and it was all filmed in Hamilton, Ontario. Canada seems to be the source for your TV reunion movie. All the Trial of the Incredible Hulk was Vancouver.
All right, yes.
Loaded with Canadian actors,
Yeah, well, I remember seeing that the G-Force stuff down at Comic-Con. I think I'd called you about that, Alex, and I grabbed you a cap or whatever it was. But I was thinking how cool it would have been, whatever this thing was going to look like. You probably would have had a whole new range of toys or action figures, at least. Because I really do feel like as much stuff as there is out there, none of it's it's all pretty fragile stuff. And it's incredibly hard to find. Then you get the diamond stuff that was made in the late 90s or whatever it was, early 2000s. And that's great. It's good stuff. But it's 3 points of articulation. And then some of it, I can't find – I've got an unmasked Jason, which came with a DVD set. But to try to find a masked Jason figure is $80 or $100 because they
really
that's a weird thing. Those were on clearance immediately, and then some, because I remember a friend of mine who's in a notorious Gatchaman fan, and he's a comic publisher as well. I went to his house one day, and
he's a comic publisher. Would I know him?
Yeah, well, you might. Eric Coe. He runs Udon Publishing.
Oh yeah, yeah, Eric Coe.
Yeah, I went to his garage about 10 years ago, and we were just talking, and there was just a stack of Gatchaman figures in there.
And, wait a minute, didn't Eric color the comics I was involved with?
Could be. I'm not.
I'm forgetting now, but I want to say I worked with him, and I think it might have been that his studio, Udon, colored the books for Top Cow did the covers for.
Very well could be. I haven't actually seen Eric in a while, but he had a stack of those second run Diamond figures, and he said, "Oh, Diamond was clearing those out, and I don't mind buying some." And I remember, like a couple years later, somebody telling me that like Zoltar was going for like $75.
Oh.
And it was like, holy smoke, I think I have Zoltar's girl head in my drawer here.
Yeah.
It's like I said, I don't feel like they ever really got a true...
Well, like I mean, we know from having made these...
No, line? Toy line?
I'm sorry?
I don't feel like they ever got like a full toy line, an updated, you know, toy line, action figures, vehicles, you know, a unified sort of toy line. One's ever really tackled that or done that.
You were saying about the numbers of the comic series, Alex?
Just that, you know, we found out by doing the revival of the comics that even though we started off with, you know, a fair amount of attention and support that was given to us, that we quickly fell in the numbers of what the series was doing. And for whatever that might mean, it might relate strictly to the quality of the product we made or just simply general reaction of people kind of unified looking at it going, well, we really don't remember this that well, but we were excited for a moment when things like Masters of the Universe and G.I. Joe were suddenly coming back in comic form, and this was one of those things that rode that wave. In fact, I was trying to fight Wizard on this sort of grouping of Battle of the Planets being thrown in with a 80s revival article that they were creating based around it.
I remember that article.
It's not the 80s.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Like, it never was. It was the 70s. I was there.
Yeah, I remember that article, and I remember being like, well, A, that was the 70s, and B, it was not on that curve of the toy commercial animated show. You know, like, there's a completely different connection with He-Man. Like, we didn't get Battle of the Planets action figures. It's very different. So yeah, I agree with you on that. It is.
Well, the tough part, you know, that was my one chance selling them on. I think it was partly the way the article started off was they had done something similar to it before that I think focused on G.I. Joe and maybe Transformers that had original artwork created by probably J. Scott Campbell and other people showing like, hey, remember this? You know, but these properties were not in current use then.
Yeah.
They hadn't been published in a while. So that prompted me to say to the editors I was in contact with, hey, I'd love to do a piece about the planets. You could do an article about these older cartoon shows mixed in. I never thought for a second they're going to turn around and make the article somehow focused around the singular thought of it being the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, yeah, they were in syndication still at that time, but that's not what, you know, either way, I got my chance to illustrate them the one time. I thought that was going to be it until Sandy Frank's representative contacted, I guess Wizard is how it first started, and we got hooked up where I brought in Top Cow as the publisher. I contacted a friend I had there, and basically we made a revival happened in print. And it rode that wave that basically we had no real reasonable association to.
Really? Yeah, I can totally understand that. And
but it was sort of stuck that way. Like they forced that association where none existed.
Yeah, yeah. It's a mistake. It's the wrong marketplace. You know, it's funny because even like I said in 1981, it was a hard to find show in my market.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kicked down to the 6:30 in the morning crowd. So I don't know who that is anymore.
Yeah,
alcoholics, the unemployed. You know,
no, they're past out by 6:30.
Yeah.
So is the Japanese, should I track down the Japanese movie? Is it worth tracking down?
The new live action?
Yeah.
I don't, I watched it without subtitles.
Really?
Yeah, well, we were just, I will buy a copy, but that takes a while to find.
Well, so I did buy a copy, and that's how I've seen it. It's,
is it out?
Okay.
I got given a copy of it, and I thought, well, I am going to buy this, so I'll watch it. And I do want to see it actually with.
Well, you know what'll shock you with the subtitles?
Mm-hmm.
You'll be reading it going, who's George?
Oh.
He's referring to George.
Oh, no.
Who's George?
Well, the problem is that what happens with a lot of subtitles that are created for these kind of projects is it's not English first speakers who are doing the translating for our benefit, which means that if they don't know the American or English understanding of these characters, well, this doesn't make any sense under any reason because the names are the same for the characters, whether it's English or Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Joe is he's written in the subtitles as George.
Weird.
And I was like, wait a minute, did they change the character's name? And I'm listening closely every time his name is spoken. It's like, nope, that was Joe.
Yeah.
How did somebody get this wrong? But it's not the only defect. There's lots of language defects that occur in the subtitles. But, you know, that's life. That happens, right?
One of my issues with that and the Star Blazers film I watched was these things were animation. So therefore, there was no limit on the special effects or the scope of something they wanted to do. And
right.
When they do them in live action now, they're doing things like, you know, they're turning they're doing some kind of derivative things like the Gamelons in the Star Blazers movie are kind of like monsters now, and the Galactor goons are now kind of, I don't know what you'd call them, if they're like cyborgs or, and I agree with updating things, but I also kind of thought, well, if they wanted them to be cyborg monsters, they would have made them cyborg monsters.
Exactly,
because,
yeah.
I mean,
all the redesigns that appear in the Gatchaman movie, they're out there to sort of say, hey, look at how far we can take this, but they don't improve. They don't make it better.
Yeah, and showing, you know, I always thought that the G-Force team looked really amazing and dynamic when they would fight, and I was hoping to see that in live action, and instead they've gone even further to where they're like leaping over buildings, and that wasn't really, it was well done, but it wasn't how I ever envisioned them. You know, it's weird. It wasn't a deal breaker for me, but I just was kind of like, you know, it was cool the way it was, and I wanted to see it. You know?
Well, like, especially when you take in mind, like, their alter egos, when you see the young people out of costume, you're thinking, okay, well, they'll be more contemporary because that's the way of all things.
Yeah.
But they're not contemporary in any way that is exciting or interesting. It's sort of like ho-hum.
Yeah, you know? I wasn't expecting the numbered shirts either, but it did.
I want the striped trousers. That's what I want to
see.
But, I mean, that would have been so much more. I mean, imagine if they truly embraced what it had been.
Yeah.
How much fun it might have been.
What's that?
I could care less about whether the actors were Asian, but, you know, the fact that the characters don't have any of those aesthetics, the long hair, the 70s kind of clothes, those things have a certain quality to them that is a sad loss when it's not there.
And where was the ping pong table?
Nah, it was cool to see that the Dr. Nambu character was exactly
yes.
the same guy.
He looked perfect.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. They had the long hair, he had the suits,
yeah.
you know, and yes, he is an Asian actor playing a character that looked Caucasian, but it didn't matter. You could see exactly who the guy was.
Absolutely. And even the 3/4 length jacket, which is,
but then,
you know
they have like the design for June, her character, she's wearing black with like a little bit of magenta trim inside of the cape. And you think like, well, that's not a really great translation of a swan, is it?
No. I mean, my one of the things my wife said while watching is, well, I'm kind of glad I'm not staring at her panties every 5 seconds. But, you know, that is kind of I did kind of think that they could have done something that was reflective of the original character a little more. With, you know, they didn't have to go full on pink, but, you know.
Well, in the Imagi version, the one that was going to be the feature animated thing. That was going to be more of a magenta look for her entire costume. Mm. So they were taking the fact that she wore pink, exaggerating that, and so she would have been like the red member of the team, effectively.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. But
you know, they were really good designs, the ones that we'll never see the light of day now, unfortunately.
It's really too bad. You don't think it'll ever get resurrected by someone else? Or?
Well, somebody else, and then yeah. whatever thing they might do next will be you know, completely their own invention and influenced by their own time. You know, maybe by that point, we won't even have actors doing these things anymore. It'll be all CG. But just like, you know, the Imagi movie was going to be animated. You know, the tough part of this is Gatchaman was a sensation in Asia 40-some years ago.
Yeah.
And the connection of the people who remember how much of a sensation it is grows weaker with each passing generation.
Do you remember this, Alex? This was around the time that the internet kind of boomed. Gatchaman became a hit in Korea mid-90s, mid to late 90s. And I was dealing with a U.S. soldier stationed over there, and he was pulling out these wacky, like some of these toys were just awesome, and other things were kind of just a little bit, they're cool, but they were huge. They were all huge, and like they would basically paint over a Power Ranger to look like Mark, you know. And it would come with this huge clunky gun that had nothing to do with Battle of the Planets. And
wow.
They did do a beautiful 5-pack of the figures in vinyl, but the box—I
just got that actually.
Yeah, the box is like 2 feet tall or something. I remember.
I thought that was an old toy, and I bought it from a collector, in the store, and then I got it home and saw that the copyright on it was just from like what, 2009 or something like that.
No, I think it was late 90s. This one I'm thinking of. It's a huge box though, and you can tell it's got Korean kanji on it.
Okay.
Yeah, and they did model kits. They did all kinds of stuff. I was actually, it got a little gross. Like I was getting so many boxes from this guy, and eventually, you know, none of it really clicked, and we sold it all. But it was kind of neat to have at the time. It was kind of neat that they were going through this you know, the show by that point was like 25 years old.
Right. Yeah, there's some stuff I actually found, I think, on eBay that I sent you links to, which was like there's one set that's like a Mark's, you know, helmet or mask and a gun and a sword and a belt, and another one is like nunchucks and a sword and a belt or something. And you said that they were from Korea. They were licensed, but they were products that were made in Korea at a certain point.
Yeah, their license might be questionable. I'm not 100% on that, but they're definitely like the show went through a really late run of popularity there.
Oh, there's an anecdote I wanted to share with you that I talked about with Jason before, and it's something, you know, somewhat interesting to the perspective of where this property was in the States and where it could have gone. And that is the entire time that I was doing what little I contributed to the comics that were made here in the early 2000s, we never did the thing we were actually building up to do, which was to introduce new expanded characters into the team, expanding the roster of the birds that make up this bird-based group.
So you were going to do like a Justice League of birds, essentially? Like, you know, like...
Well, you see, the thing is, it wasn't our idea to begin with. It was Sandy Frank's representative who appealed to us in the making of the comic book, say, hey, how about expansion of the character base? And it was just sort of a rough thing thrown out there. It got my mind percolating, and then I discussed it with the writer, and you know, we only had some things roughly laid out, and there was not extensive sketches, none of which had been printed, that I put together. But what we started to formulate was an idea that we would introduce, this is a standard kind of plot idea, but the idea that before the Gatchaman we know, there was a prototype team that was made that basically they had the experience of testing out these various gifts that the characters had, with some earlier teenagers and, again, earlier bird types, and that within that context, this group that you've never heard of before, that there was an interior betrayal in that group. There was one of the members who went rogue, who went to go work for Galactor and ultimately betrayed his fellow Gotchaman. And, you know, we would have set up basically that you could find those Gotchaman again. They would somehow be powering some kind of chrysalis somewhere where we could free them, and they would be preserved as they were young people. So now we could unite the old with the new. But the thing is, what we thought, the writer and I, is we've got to reestablish the base of what this essential concept of the group is. You can't just jump forward into this brand new iteration of, you know, 5 to 6 new members. You know, you got to reestablish the main characters, their essential first adventure, and kind of get the audience used to them. We thought we might be doing this comic for years. We only wound up doing it for 12 issues.
Yeah.
We had assorted specials. We had a crossover with Thundercats and all the stuff we got to do that was really fun, and I'm very proud of it. But it was seeing weaker and weaker returns with each iteration. The last series that Top Cow published, we even did in black and white to save on color costs. It's beautiful in black and white, though, I must say. It looks very much like manga. It's very cool.
Yeah, I have a bunch of those issues. I have to dig them out. I was hoping to do it prior to this, but didn't find the time.
But here's the upshot of it that's interesting, is that the idea, once we were finally discussing where things were going with the Sandy Frank company representative, is that the intention was we would set this up, whatever we do create, which we'd never shown him any of. He never saw a single sketch or heard any single concept from me. But they wanted to build, with me as a participant, a way of using the G-Force name, which they invented and they owned, into a way of branding their own thing that, as you might guess it, would mean they'd never have to pay any more licensing money back to Tatsunoko. And once that was explained to me, and I'm sort of thinking, wait a minute, I would be creating this thing that would be now owned by you, and I guess you'd give me a piece, a taste, but you would never have to pay the people that I was essentially stealing the intellectual work from.
Yeah.
And I just thought, that doesn't seem very reasonable to me. That seems like, well, we see it done in movies and pop culture work all the time. You know, it's a constant. But the thing is that once you put your name that you do own on top of it, it's very clear what you just ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact, if I'm designing any of these characters to be, because I said that they were going to be further bird-based characters. You know, I was going to have a cardinal to just have a red one. You know, I was thinking of all different, not that I know birds that well, but, you know, there have been a crane and, you know, because I believe the crane is very popular in Japan and whatnot. Well, yeah, I was also going to change up the races, too, to have it be more multicultural as well. Well, the thing is that, you know, we couldn't see eye to eye, of course. I was seeing it as the issue of, that seems reasonably questionable to me. Like,
right.
I would feel not good about doing that to Tatsunoko.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's fair. Tatsunoko
they've never done anything to me that's wrong. They've only given me this thing that I really appreciate. And, of course, there wasn't much. I'm not sure how big the operation is representing Tatsunoko, if it's just the inherent family that had started up the business years ago. I have no idea if a single creator of the original show participates in anything. You know, but, of course, we know if you're dealing with, say, something like Mazinga, you're still going to deal with the original manga creator, Go Nagai. You know, he's still going to control that. He can control whether or not anything more gets made out of that. And so there is a certain amount of rights that do exist in Japan that have benefited creators over years. So, well, anyways, you get the idea.
I've been vaguely familiar with that, but yeah, I kind of suspected that, but I didn't. I'm not sure of the Tatsunoko situation at all either. And I've never really done anything with it. I think my friend Eric has attempted to license some. He was trying to license some props at one point, like doing the boomerang and that sort of thing. I don't know whatever happened with that.
I've got a kind of a working one of those myself. The bird thing. I've got a. Well, there was one that was a model kit that was passed around, and I've got a beautiful finished painted one assembled. That's part of my statue.
I think about 10 years back, somebody re-released that beautiful die-cast God Phoenix that has all the little vehicles.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And did that not come with a replica of the boomerang?
I don't think. Ooh. I've only seen it on...
Yes, it did.
Okay,
did it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they released two different versions of it with different stuff, and one of them, I believe, came with a replica. But I think it's just a simple piece of molded plastic.
It is, but to my wife, it was like wish fulfillment because she used to make out of Lego as a kid. So
yeah.
See, somebody needs to do something. So
yeah,
maybe I'll talk to someone with a toy company and see if we can come up with some ideas.
See that you do. And somebody a couple of years ago, remember there was a video game. I think it's Capcom versus Tatsunoko, and you could actually I'm not a video game guy, I don't know if you guys are, but you could actually like pit Street Fighter characters versus a Mark from Battle of the Planets.
Yes, that's right. It was just very recent. Yeah,
and they released a small action figure.
Yeah, hang on. Sorry.
I believe that'll be cut out of your final edit.
Yes, well, you know what? We sometimes leave the puppies in. there was a 3¾-inch action figure released around 4 or 5 years ago that's mm-hmm. really brilliant. I bought it for $10.
Oh, the one it's like a G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
Takara made it, I think. It's like a
Microman. Yeah.
Yeah, I have that. I think I have that somewhere.
Yeah, I love that figure, and it
came with a little boomerang, right?
Yeah, and how hard would it have been to do the rest of the team?
Exactly. It's always they did. Do you remember the ones that Ben Presto did like 10, 12 years ago, where they did there were like little figures that came in the crane machines?
Oh yeah, the Gashapon.
Gashapon. Yeah.
They
did a Mark. With a little boomerang, and I think his arms moved, his head moved, and that was it. But yeah, again, do the rest of the damn team. Someone's doing like little super deformed ones that are out.
Yeah, they're out.
Those are out currently. And then there was a sort of Lego-ish set that came out. Like
I remember that. Yeah, that might be longer than 10 years ago.
But again, these are all like variations on a theme. Like no one has just done a full-on action figure set, vehicles, etc. I think the Phoenix was, I think, offered through Diamond or something, because there were two, like you said, the different versions. I seem to remember one.
Yes, there were.
One had like a plastic flame case that went on top of the ship.
That's right. I saw that the other day, actually.
Yeah,
yep, that's part of my collection. Yeah.
Yeah, try to find that stuff now. It's pricey. So
I think the favorite thing I snagged in all the collecting, because there was, you know, there's things like figures in the One Rover One, was I finally managed, you know, you just kind of play the waiting game looking for the right price. And it was the, it came just before Christmas, so I gave it to her for Christmas. There's a company called Idai Grip in Japan, and they made these beautiful Hot Wheels sized figure or ships of, like, you know, Jerry Anderson stuff,
they made one of the single greatest James Bond collectibles in the history of Bond. They made a Lotus Esprit in 1977. The wheels folded in, fins came out, missile shot. I mean, it was just like it came out of the movie.
Yeah.
But it had stickers on it, like the Japanese tend to do. But it was by Grip, and it's a bitch to find. But go ahead. I'm sorry. So
they did the Phoenix, and it comes in this wonderful little box. And Grip was really weird because they would take these little liberties. Like, I love the Jerry Anderson Show UFO, and they have these big shadow vehicles, these like tanks, and they're green or they're kind of odd colored, dark colors. Well, the Grip is pink. So, you know, they just did, and it's like hot pink, like fuchsia, you know, your aunt's stretch pants. But for the Phoenix, they just did the straight blue and red, and it looks smashing. And it's the toy that if you saw it as a kid, it would be your favorite toy for the summer.
Well, I know from artwork I got to do for the DVD collections that were released by ADV of the entire series, some of the new art I got to create, I was using those toys, like the big Phoenix that was released through Diamond. I used that as a model because it had a metallic paint finish, and if you lit it well, you could get nice reflections on the body of it, and it had all the details accurate as best I could tell. So Some of those
speaking of details,
pieces of merchandise have been used for artwork I got to make.
Speaking of details, God knows we could go over many, many more for a long time now, but we're going to have to wrap this sucker up because we're coming up on 2 hours, I think, almost of nonstop conversation.
That is no surprise to me.
I figured that would happen. You get people passionate about stuff. I'd like to talk.
Well, thankfully, I'll never have to talk about this ever again. I'm very, very happy about that.
I'm happy we're the definitive version of this, Chad.
Yes.
Final conversation on it. That was pretty good and healthy. We covered the history of Battle of the Planets, Gatchaman, G-Force, and every other name of it. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time and being a guest and talking about this stuff. We appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Hope you had fun, and we can do it again anytime, any subject that rings a bell. Bowie's getting anxious. He spotted something in the reflection of the display case that's making him crazy.
You know,
God knows what.
I've got a dog to walk too.
Well, there you go. Alex, I'll be in touch.
All right.
To you, Hyler, and thank you so much. This was great. I can't wait to hear it back.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See you in 30.
Bye.